yours.
I need a drink. My name is Malcolm, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can tell you nothing but good things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA, and I love the fellowship. And it's a great honor to be asked to speak or to participate in recovery. And particularly in this meeting, I feel very close to a lot of people sitting in this room. My story as an alcoholic is my story. And what I'm going to share is my story. Not your story, but my story. And it's my experience and my strength and my hope that I offer to you today. And if you be sitting here and you're feeling as though your life has fallen apart and you have no idea how you're ever going to be able to get all the pieces and put them back together again, I understand. I understand. So newcomers, you're welcome here. With all my heart, I tell you, you're welcome here. Because when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't welcome anywhere. And I was so disappointed in the way things had turned out that I was not even comfortable in my own skin. I was just broken. And I tell you that you're welcome, because when you said to me when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, September 12th, 1989, you said, "Welcome, Malcolm. Can I get you a cup of coffee?" And I just couldn't believe that you were saying that, because I just didn't feel welcome anywhere, and I wouldn't welcome me, and I have to tell you that you said something else that I want to tell you. As a newcomer, you can, if you hear this, I want you to remember it. You're welcome to keep coming back. Keep coming back. Now, you might not be able to make it back. That's the problem. But if there's any chance you can make it back, please. I want you to know that you're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my life, so many years ago, was very, 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 very different than it is today. I grew up in a coal mining town in England, and my dad was a coal miner, and I lived in a coal mining community, and life was harsh, so I remember as being harsh, a very different life than I live today. Material comforts came and went, and on a Christmas you might get if you were lucky, an orange or, some walnuts in a stocking. And that was a big deal, you know. I grew up in poverty. On Friday nights, it was a ritual to get the lice out of your hair. It was a ritual. You had to do this, and you went to grandma's house, and you stood up in line, and the person who had the dirtiest tide mark, I don't know if you know what a tide mark is, but if you haven't took a wash, you know, the only thing you've washed is your face. The dirt here makes a mark, and it's a line that shows like a tide mark. And so my grandma would line us up according to the degree of tide marks, and the dirtiest person would take the last bath in the kettle, big old kettle bin she used to have. And you used to boil the water and put it in the kettle bin. And it was a Friday night ritual, because you didn't take baths except for that kind of experience. When I was a kid, there was showers. I had no idea what a shower was. There wasn't a television to watch. Gas, we were in this transition from gas to electric, so growing up, you know, it was like coal fires and gas light, and I was responsible for making the fires, and I had to get up at 4 o'clock, make a coal fire in one of the rooms, and then shovel it to the next room very carefully, not to drop any coal into the next fireplace, and start the fire in the next room, and slowly but surely the house would warm up. And then when you'd got up, if you were lucky enough to eat, you'd get some bread and you'd get a stick and put the white bread on the stick and put it near the fire to get some toast. And I loved black toast. The smell of black toast today brings me back memories. It's funny how that is. I think I suffered from alcoholism before I took my first drink. I lived in a life which, to me, now in retrospect, I thought it was normal, but it was not normal. It was very dysfunctional, and it was based on survival of the fittest. And so I learned very early in life that if I was to live, I was to survive. And I learned how to survive. And I did whatever it took to do that. My dad made his own beer in the shed. I got a taste of it when I was about 9. And I loved the taste of it. It went down my throat. It was thick, coated ginger beer. And I remember drinking that and getting so drunk. But I was I was glowing. You could have put me on top of the Christmas tree and I would have looked like it. Yeah, I felt like the effect was like, and I think what it was, it gave me relief from me and you and it. And that pretty much was it, you know, until I found out at about 9 or 10, my mother was dying of cancer. And it was about a 2 or 3 year period from her going from a fairly stocky woman to a woman who was a skeleton. They put us in a home, a residential home. Kids were split up, put in homes. I've got 2 brothers, 2 sisters, I'm the eldest son. And, you know, it was this sense of being so somehow helpless that you felt this ache inside. I know this quiet desperation was developing very early in my life, and it wasn't until my mother died that I was pulled out of the role of going to school. By the way, I was always getting into trouble at school, because you can imagine living in a household that was dysfunctional and having a rageaholic as a father who his job was to break your will. And he tried to break mine, believe me. And I was very defiant. I was very mischievous. I was a liar. I told him lies. And even I couldn't imagine anybody would believe him. I mean, he sent me once for a loaf of bread. And I was so hungry. By the time I came back with a loaf of bread, they didn't slice bread in those days. That's new technology. they were just baked from the baker. The baker, these beautiful, God, it smelled so good. And I was so hungry, I started picking at the one end of it. And by the time I got home, the entire inside of the bread was hollow. And if I'd have turned it around, it would have looked like it was a whole loaf. But if I'd have turned it around the other side, it was empty. And I knew I was about to get another beating. And at all costs, I'd learned to lie or blame my brother for everything. If you have a younger brother, they come in very handy. I blamed him for everything, you know, I was going to get my ass kicked, and I told him, and I went into drama. That I learned how to be really, I said, "Dad, you don't understand. Dad, it was so bad. What happened was that the rats." They came, you know, I dropped the loaf and I tried to kick them away, but they were so big. And they started to eat the inside of the bread. And I just like wanted to get them away from me, because we need to eat, Dad, right? We need to eat. And so, and I finally kicked them away, Dad. I think I got hurt, but it's okay. Don't worry. I'm going to make it, Dad. And he looked at me, you know, like, and he said to the next door neighbor, he shouted through the window, "Howard," he was the guy who lived next door, "come over here." He says, Howard comes up, he says, "You've got to hear this shit. Tell him what you just told me." And I thought he was serious. And I started crying and feeling really like he believed me. And you know, I guess, I don't know. One of those days where he decided it was a day off from beating kids, you know, so I didn't get whipped, you know. It worked, so I thought. But I give you that as an example of how I was set up in the world to see the people in the world as people to somehow manipulate or get out of their way or avoid them or give them what they want, and then somehow you'll be able to control them. Now, I tell you these things because, you see, if I was to fast forward the tape and then go back into my history and look at my causes and conditions, those are the causes and conditions that I had to look at. And what I found when I looked back through my inventory process was that I was running on fear most of my life. I was running on fear most of my life, and there wasn't, as far as I can remember, a lot of experience of being able to relax and just kind of explore and talk things through and share your feelings with somebody and ask them about this or that. Life was too demanding, and there was simply no place for that, no time and attention for that kind of stuff. So when I left, and I left when my dad put me in the coal mines, I want you to know, he let me wear long pants. Now, I'm 6'3", guys, and I've always been 6'3", it seems. Always been tall, lanky. They called me Lanky Lindstedt. And I couldn't wear long pants until I was 14. Now, can you imagine me walking around with short pants? That's a sign that you're still a child. You're not a man until you wear long pants. And when I went to the coal mines, he let me wear long pants. He also let me smoke. And he let me drink a pint of beer. Because I was a man. And he got me the job. And so that's what I did. I drank. I smoked and coughed, and smoked and coughed and drank, but I got a taste for the liquor, and it was for me, it was beer, mainly in the beginning, but later it was harder stuff. Excuse me, I have to take a drink. It's not easy to go back and think about these things. I have hurt a lot of people in my life. What I'm talking about is my childhood, eventually leading into a life I left England when I was 16, about a little bit before 16. I'd been in the coal mines 18 months, and the coal mines are hell for me. I don't know. My dad was very upset that I left because he'd given me these privileges, and he got me the job, and I just told him, it's not for me, Dad. I'm not going to stay. And he said, you're ungrateful. I said, no, I'm not ungrateful. I can always come back to this. I don't know why they get to have their life and I don't get to have mine. You see, I was still comparing me, and I was always falling short. And I'm having this feeling that somehow I don't measure up. And I said to my dad, I'm out of here. And he did the physical thing with me. And I stood up to him and put him down. And I said, you'll never hurt me again, you hear? And I wept my eyes out as I'm doing it, because I can tell you, if you've ever been in that position where you've took your father or your mother and you've grabbed them and jacked them up and you've took beatings from them and just took them, I stood up against him, and I guess I told him, you know, I said, you know, I'm getting older and stronger and you're getting older and weaker. If you lay a finger on me again, you'll regret it, you hear me? And don't you ever touch my brothers and sisters. Leave them alone. And I suddenly felt as though, you know, I was now able to take care of myself. And he said, you leave this family, you don't have a Lindstedt. You don't have a surname Lindstedt. You're out of here. And he cut me off. I mean, cut me off from what? I don't know. But he cut me off from what I consider my roots. And so I went off feeling totally, I would just say, mixed up about stuff. People would say, well, where are you going, Malcolm? I said, I'm going where John Lennon's going. Where are you going? I said, where's John Lennon going? I said, he's going to India. That's where I'm going. I'm going where the Beatles are going. And the Beatles were a big part of my life, you know. And I got a sign that I made and folded it into three pieces. So it was about this long. You could open it up. It was pretty long. And it said, non-violent. That's what it said on it, non-violent. I got a rucksack, and I put a stitched a Union Jack to it, and I got the sign, and I put my hand out and thumb out, and stuck the Union Jack out there, and I just got rides, and they said, where are you going? I said, well, where are you going? I'm going where you're going. And you say, I've always been going where you're going, and I've always been doing what you're doing. And that was a setup for me in life. And I got very lonely, and I got very cold. And I braced myself, and I slept in bushes and like homeless people, but I was on an adventure. I didn't see myself as homeless. I saw myself as like Columbus. Yeah, I was going to discover America, my America. And for 3 years I hitchhiked around Europe. But I have to tell you, in those 3 years I developed a taste for lager. and German beer, and loved Oktoberfest, and I started yodeling, and I started playing a harmonica, and I could entertain people, and I became kind of a character, you know? And I used to tell, like, funny jokes, and they'd laugh, and I'd laugh, and we'd have a beer together, and then I didn't have any money, but so I guess I thought I was, like, doing my part, I was making you laugh. And that's how my life was. I was always trying to make people happy, but really trying to control them. And that three-year period, I drank as much as I could drink to feel those highs that would somehow remove me from my predicament. And I didn't know I was in a predicament. It's a pretty long word. My dad used to say, "Why do you use these big words?" I said, "What, like but?" But I did use big words because I was always trying to act like I was like intelligent, you know, and smart, you know, and better than you, and I knew stuff, and I was always interested in stuff and curious, and even as a kid, I remember getting I think they ripped the skin off my back because they could cane you, you know, when I went to school. It was a very different period. You have to put your hand out and they bamboo you. You get these bamboo sticks and they flip your finger. You could only do three on each hand. And six, they had to register in a book. And I was always getting registered in the book for getting the... And then when they really tried to humiliate you, they on Friday have all the kids up on the stage and the headmaster would whip your fingers. And I was so good at it. I could lower my hand exactly at the time the cane was coming down, and it looked like he'd really hit me, but he hadn't. And I would scream like I was. But he hadn't even fazed me, you know. I learned how to stuff stuff down my butt so that when they came the back of the butt, I would scream like it was hurting me, but I didn't feel it. And I still like, yeah, I sucked it up, you know, I sucked it up. And I can tell you, those 3 or 4 years of being in Europe, I got an education. I learned that there were other cultures, there were other peoples and races, and there were other people that didn't think like me and spoke different languages. And I became fascinated by the Europeans, and I went to places where people would like introduce me to things. You know, I got to like do hashish. And that's pretty classy stuff. And I got to do they had this they had this wine that was like you're supposed to know the difference between red and white wine, and you're supposed to know when you drink the red with what foods and when you drink the white with what foods, and I learned that. And I had no ability to spend any money to buy some wine, but I used to try to impress people about what I knew. And yet, I didn't feel like I was connected to anything. And I have to tell you that alcohol was working for me more and more. And after about 3 or 4 years of being a total drunk, an absolute drunk. In fact, my brother emailed me today and said, "Do you remember at Christmas when we had nothing and you would teach me how to get into the beer keg that Dad had made the beer?" And I forgot all about that. And it's funny, I'm talking about it tonight. But I have to tell you that I was in my heart and in my gut, this hole was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I couldn't put enough stuff in there to fill it up. It would feel okay for a while because I lived on these highs and lows. You know, somebody would pick me up and they would be real nice and they'd let me use their apartment or flat, as it's called in Europe, and I could take a bath, you know, and I could sleep on a floor or on a couch. And that was a big deal to me. And then I would be off and thinking, God, I feel good. And I was on a high, and then it would get cold and it would rain, and wind would blow, and it was like, I was on a low and feeling like, what the hell is it all about? What is it about? What's this thing called? I mean, why does this happen to me? Look at those people. Why don't I get to drive a car? And you see, I was full of self-pity and didn't know it. And I don't know if you can relate to that, but I have to tell you, when I came to America, I decided I was going to do something with my life. And what I did is I came to America without any education. And I came on a visitor's visa. I managed to get some money together. And I came to America, and I was drinking fairly regular. It was part of my daily life, you know, just having a beverage of some kind. I just still was drinking beer pretty much. I had a pretty good gut on me, but I have to tell you that when I came to America, there was a man, I'll never forget him. He taught me how to make Manhattans, and how to put cherries in them and mix them up, and how to make a martini and olives and shake them. It was a brand new world to me, and I started mixing drinks, and I made them pitcherfuls, and I was drinking them by the pitcher, and I got like really quick results from that. I mean, very fast results from that. But the one thing that Walter did, he sat down with me and he got to know me, and I told him, I said, "What is your plans?" I mean, I said, "Well, I guess I'm going to go back to England. I don't know what to do. I can always go back to the wire industry or the coal mines, you know." And he was a pretty good drinker. He knew how to belt him back and take shots and drink them. And he used to do that with me. And I used to love to hang out with Walter because he would provide the alcohol. And what happened was he sat down and took an interest in me. And I said, he said, "Why don't you go to school?" I said, "Well, what I want to, I mean, come on, Walt. I mean, you know," I said, I'm not going to be able to, school? What do you mean?" He says, "Why don't you go to school?" He says, "You know, maybe you could go to school here." I said, no way. And he said, "Well, you'll have to pass your GED. I said, "What the hell is a GED? General Equivalency Diploma." And I said, "Well, I couldn't do that. What do you have to do?" He says, "Oh, you have to know history and algebra and stuff like that." And I says, "Well, I can't do that. I'm stupid. I've been told that. I know I'm stupid. I can't do that stuff." He says, "You're not stupid, Malcolm. You're uneducated." I said, "I'm uneducated." He said, "Yeah, you need an education." And so that's what happened. He sat down with me, this man, and he studied that book, you know, the Baron's book on how to pass the GED. And he sat down with me for 3 months. And I only had 6 months in America before I had to leave. And he sat down with me and he made arrangements for me to take this test. And I took these five tests and I passed this exam with 3 points. If I'd have got 3 points less, I would have failed it. And to me, I was like ashamed of this. And yet on the other level, I was thinking, "God, I've got a GED." And I'll never forget what he said. He says, "Look, Malcolm," he says, "I've got this GED here. It's got your name on it." He says, "If I got the GED from the guy who did the best in the study," he says, "and I looked at that," he says, "the only difference would be names." He says, "There's no way you can tell." He said, "They're both opportunities. They're keys to a door." And I'll never forget Walter. And he said, "You know, go get yourself an education." And so I did. I transferred from a visitor status to a student status. You could do that back in the 70s. You have to leave the country now. You can't do it in the country. And what happened is I still had this big, you know, this sense of like I'm nobody. But suddenly I had a GED, and I can tell you, I mean, some days I found myself strutting, like I was a, you know, "You should call me Dr. Linstead now." And yet I had an entire education to acquire, and for years, about 7 or 8 years, I stayed in school, because as long as I stayed in school and I met the academic requirements of the school, I could stay in the country. So that was the motivator. I didn't have to go back to the coal mines. Now, there's a new culture. By the way, I met this culture in Europe. It's the American youth. And I liked them. I was drawn to them. And I had a lot of fun with them. But I became part of the American culture. And the American youth, particularly, and we smoked pot together, and we talked, we solved the world's problems. We smoked pot together and ordered pizza, and we smoked some more pot and just went, somebody says to me, "Did you do that term paper?" "What term paper?" "We have a term paper." "Oh, shit, tomorrow?" You see, I was always like adrenaline. I've got to do it at the 11th hour. And so when I'm loaded, I thought I did a better job. And so I would I would get through school, and I was always finding the people to hang with who got the stuff. And I got a social security number, and I could start working. So I worked and washed windows, and I knew how to put wallpaper on walls and put linoleum down and paint houses and stuff like that. And that's what I did to get myself through college. But I was always like having to buffer this experience of living. I always had to have somehow, I had to take the edge off it. I still had this sense of being nowhere, in nowhere's land, you know. And I was drinking harder, I was doing more stuff, and I was having relationships. And, you know, lots of them. And I don't remember half of them, but they told me I had relationships. I think it felt good. But I have to tell you that I was desperate to belong to somebody or be with somebody. And I would fall in love at the drop of a hat. You know, I just needed, it seemed, to get somebody to love me. And I met this woman and we got married, and we stayed together for 7 years. Now, you know, I was becoming somebody, and I was drinking more and more and more as I was becoming. And the truth of the matter is after 7 years, there was nothing that we had in common. I had these degrees now. I had met all these people. I wasn't, you know, feeling like I was a nobody. In fact, I thought I'd become somebody. Even my dad wanted to talk to me. And I have to tell you, you know, all of a sudden my photo album became colored. It was black and white up to then. And all of a sudden I've got symbols of achievement. I can prove, yeah, I got a GD, I got an AA, I got a bachelor's degree, master's degree. What you got? You see, it's like, you know, I'm better than you. But I was always like acting like that. And the truth of the matter is I didn't feel at all better than anybody. I felt very much less than. But I would never tell you that. I would never let on. I can't believe that I'm saying that in front of a group of people. But the truth of the matter is that I needed more and more of whatever it was to fix me. And alcohol fixed me real good. And eventually, when we got divorced, I immediately found the remedy was to drink myself to death. I used to drink round the clock. I had a dog at that point, and the dog was my best friend. And I would tell him all my troubles, you know. And we lived together in a pretty nice place, actually. It was a Volkswagen. And he didn't particularly like it. Well, he didn't get out much. I did. I used to leave him there. Forget I lived in there, and he used to get pissed off at me. And I used to come back, and he chewed all the goddamn knobs off of this. And there were teeth marks in the... But he was my faithful dog. In fact, I could trust him, you know, and I would love him when I get in the car and give him a big old, you know, oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, once I woke up and he was licking the vomit off my face. And I have to tell you, that's one of those pitiful, incomprehensible demoralizations that I remember. I don't ever want to forget how bad it got. Because I felt so like a failure. And I'm in a Volkswagen, and a failed marriage, and I was never, ever going to get divorced. And now I'm divorced. And so I thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll just keep drinking, and it'll be okay. But it wasn't okay. So what I did is I got married again. If you can't do it right once, you got to try it again, right? And so I got married, and I said, well, this time I'm going to do it right. I'm going to get married and have children. Yeah, that'll solve it. Have children, yeah. Having no idea what my problem was. So I had this beautiful kid, and his name is Ryan, and he's my prince. anybody got kids? Yeah. You know what I mean, that first one when he comes out? All that time you've had this dirty little secret, you never did anything right, and you look at this beautiful baby, and you say, see, that GED, that degree is nothing. This boy, And so I found out something. That boy of mine meant so much to me that I used to take him with me pretty much everywhere I went, and he would like one of the smiles for his dad, just for his dad, nobody else got it, but his dad. When I walked in the room, his beams because his papa's walked in. And I want to tell you that, that made me feel like I was, you see, that made me feel like I was somebody. And I have to tell you that I learned later in my inventory that anything that good that came into my life, I was destined to lose it. Because you see, what I was looking for is something outside that somehow needed to be found inside. And I didn't know how to do that. And so when I realized my life is going really good, and this woman I've married really likes me drinking. She thinks I'm so funny when I drink. And we have a lot of parties, and she loves doing the party and the domestic thing. And she was wonderfully domestic. She made wonderful stuff, stitching, and she did these quilts and stuff. And she make a Christmas look like, you know, something out of Charles Dickens. And I loved her for that. I mean, I really did. And we had this little prince, I'll always remember him, and he's scattering up them boxes at Christmas and falling into the boxes and sticking his head up. And I was just so happy, you know. I was just so happy that I got a drink at that. I mean, I got to drink good at that. I got to get real good and drunk at that because I'm happy. And I have to tell you that I drink... Happy things and I drink sad things. Weddings and funerals makes no difference to me. It's an occasion to drink and celebrate. And I used to upset her so much because I'd be drunk half of the time. And she said to me, I love you, Malcolm. And I said, you love me? I said, yeah. I said, well, I love you. I've no idea what I'm talking about. But I realized that she loved me. And I have to tell you, that was too much for me. So I would get a good drunk on that and think, what the hell is she talking about? She loves me. It's not, you know. Well, I can fix that. I know what I'll do. I'll have an affair. See if she loves me then. So I did. I had an affair. See, that's what I did. Because I didn't know how to be responsible, how to be grown up, how to be a real man, real father, a real husband. I didn't know nothing about intimacy. I knew about intensity. Oh, yeah, bring it on. I know how to be intense right now. We can perform. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But can you be there, Malcolm? Huh? Could you just be? Huh? So I had this affair and convinced myself, as I always did, justified and rationalized, that it was right. Because, well, she didn't talk to me like I think she should talk to me. My wife is really, we're not communicating. And anyway, I'm growing up now, and it's time for me to move on. And I'm making really good money. I'm out of college. I'm making all this money. I'll pay her child support, and I'll see my kid on a regular basis, and that was it. I got married to this. I got divorced from her, and I got married to this other woman, and I immediately got her pregnant, and I hadn't even the ink on the divorce papers is not even dry, and I'm already like, you know, in a new relationship. You see what's happening now is I cannot stand it. Being in me. I cannot stand being with me. I have to be with you. You have to take care of me. I can't take care of me. You take care of me. And so I realized I'd broken somebody's heart. I don't know if you've ever broken somebody's heart, but when you get in touch with that reality, it's not an easy thing to face and deal with, especially when you brought a prince into the world. And so I made it up to her. I married this woman, and I had sex with my ex-wife. And she got pregnant. Yeah, that's a smart thing to do. She got pregnant, and I had this boy. And I had to deal with it. Of course I had to deal with it. I had to be a man. Well, you couldn't find me anywhere. Where is he? Well, I don't know. Last time I saw him, he was over here. Or he's over there. No, he's lost. Malcolm's gone. You can't find him. The truth of the matter is what I had done is I had totally screwed up a beautiful relationship. I mean, I could draw these people into my life, but I didn't know how to really be what they thought I was because I created these impressions about me. You ever do that? You create impressions about yourself? It's impression management. You try to give the impression about yourself, and you want them to believe it, and they do believe it, and as soon as you realize you've got them, you realize you got this facade, and it's not true, and you're just a phony, and then you go into that self-talk of, you know, self-loathing, and you're just a loser. You're a loser, Malcolm. You're not fooling me. That's my disease talking to me. And I had to drink hard at that. I swallowed hard at that. And so what I did when I realized how I really screwed up, she took off with my prince and this baby, 2,000 miles away. Now, I have to tell you that I'm able to survive. I can survive a lot of things. There's certain kinds of stuff that can come at me, and I got a fortress around me. You just can't break it down. You can't get to me if I don't want you to get to me, and I don't want you to get to me. And so what happened is that something happened. For the first time in my life, I couldn't come up with a solution. I had a woman 2,000 miles away. I got this beautiful little boy that's just been born and this new wife. And I'm trying to figure out, well, I wonder if she would move to Illinois with me. We could move to Illinois. We'd move close to Carolyn, and then I'd be able to see Ryan and, of course, that new baby in Camden. And no, I don't think she's going to do that. Well, maybe if I got a chunk of land and bought two houses and brought them together and said, look, we'll be a happy family then. And I'll be king. It's good to be king. And you get it? I mean, this is how I couldn't solve this problem. I couldn't get my boy back. And I didn't say boys because I didn't know this ghost child. I've had a relationship with him today. But it's you need to be with your children to bond. To bond. I'm talking about a bond relationship. There's a certain period where it happens. And I didn't bond with Camden, but I bonded with the prince, Ryan. And when she did that, I started on a suicidal path, 2 to 3 years, of just drinking and drinking and drinking. And I found cocaine. I know we're not going to talk about drugs, but I have to tell you, that was the best thing that happened for me, because it accelerated my alcoholism. I got the express train to you guys. It took me... I was living in my garage at this point. Remember, I had two houses, I had a condominium. Remember, I was living in my Volkswagen way back. That was my identity. Now I'm Mr. Moneyman and symbols of achievement, and I'm getting all these awards for the stuff I'm doing. I used to work with street kids, gang kids. I used to like to go out the streets and work with them, and I was really good at it. I wonder why. I spent most of my life running around. And what happened was, I have to tell you, I just didn't know what to do. I used to cry myself to sleep in that couch. I used to drink. I used to hear voices. I knew people were in the garage listening to me. And I'm the only one there, and I knew they were listening to me, and they were trying to read my thoughts. And I started having things crawl up my arms. You ever done that? And then you say, shh. Somebody's out there, shh, quiet. And you go catatonic. You don't move for like 3 minutes. Oh, I see you've done that. Yeah. Yeah? I did that a lot. And what happened for me is that was the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization for me. I had ruined everybody's life, including my own, it seemed. I brought nothing but pain to people's life. And I wanted to be loved. I just want them to love me. Why didn't they just love me? Well, that's what they do, Mal. And as soon as you recognize that you're being loved, you sabotage it. So let me have a double. And that's what I used to do. And I'd run it over and over and over and over and over. And then I'd have a drink. And then we'd go, well, where were we? Oh, yeah, let's do that again. Make sure we covered it. And, well, she said this, and she said that, and she shouldn't have said that, and that wasn't fair, and I don't know why they did that to me, and she didn't understand anyway. She didn't know the life I had, and what? Mind your own business. I'm talking to you anyway, you know? I mean, there's nobody there but just me and me talking, you know? And that's how it was in my garage. For many, many months, I lived in darkness, and I was just drenched in depression and self-pity, hopelessness. And thought this was it. But I had no idea what was going to happen. What happened to me was extraordinary. This man who I had hired to work with me, with these kids, I'd got four homes with the six kids living in each home, and I had counselors I hired to work there. And I hired this particular man because he seemed to be very good with young people and young teenagers. And he was kind of an interesting cat, though. He had tattoos on his face, strategically placed, and they were on one side of his body, and I never fully understood that, one side. And he, on the other side, only had one leg. He had one leg, yeah. And he had tattoos, and he had hair down to about half the way down his back. And he was quite creative. He had created a Harley Davidson with the kind of a clutch situation where you could move the clutches with this adjustment he'd made. So he had a three-wheeler Harley Davidson, and that's how he'd get around. Now, I'm in my garage in September of 1989, you know, just me and them. And all of a sudden, there's this... This time is real, you know. I go, there's a little crack I used to look through in it. Oh. But he won't have none of that. Hello? Hello? Malcolm, this is Michael. Yeah? Michael Hollick, you remember me? Oh, hi, Michael. Like I was... Oh, hi, I'm in a suit and tie. I was waiting for you to show. Although, I was full of shit. And then, so the guy walks in and I said, no, I thought maybe we'd just be real quick and we'd get him out of there and I could, you know, get back with my conversations. And what happened was this, I had no idea my angel had arrived to get me. Yeah. They come in strange shapes and sizes, these angels. And what he did something that only another alcoholic knew how to do. He sat down and asked permission if he could just spend a couple of minutes with me. And I said, sure, sure, sure. And he first wanted to tell me that he wanted to thank me. Wanted to thank me. He said, first let me say I want you to thank you from the bottom of my heart for giving me a job. He says, I don't know if you know where I come from. He says, but it was hard for me to find a job. He says, but you gave me a job, and I want to thank you for that, Malcolm. I said, you're welcome. Definitely should take a shower maybe next month. And so he said to me, I just want to thank you. I don't know if you know it, but you hired somebody who's a heroin addict. And I said, I hired a heroin addict? I said, you're a heroin addict? He said, I'm an addict in recovery. I said, an addict in recovery? What's that? He says, well, I haven't had a drug, and I haven't had a drink, because I'm also an alcoholic in 14 years. I said, you shouldn't be. I said, you want some? Yeah. It's a long time to go without it, you know? And he said, you know, I lost my leg as a result of using alcohol and drugs. He said, I didn't take care of myself, and I got gangrene in my leg. And he had to take it off. He says, and that's why I can't wear a prosthesis, because I have an abscess on my knee. And he said, you know, I had about 14, 15 years ago, I hit a bottom that was just unbearable. He said, I lost my kids. You lost your kids? He says, yeah, I had a couple of boys, and I just loved them, man, you know. He says, and I lost them. And all of a sudden, what's happening? And I'm paying attention, and I'm thinking, you lost your kids. How did that happen? He says, well, I didn't have relationships. I didn't know how to even live. He says, and I got hopeless. I wanted to die. I said, and I just like, you know, choked up and not, yeah, wow. And I tried to act like I was empathy for him, but I was trying to hide my feelings. And what he said is, you know, he says, Malcolm, he says, but I'm something very different in my life today. He says, I'm pretty happy most of the time. He says, and I've got a better relationship with my kids than I probably ever have. I said, yeah, what did you do? He says, you know, I went into recovery. He says, I went to these meetings, this fellowship is where I went. He says, it's a meeting where people like me get together and we share, you know, just share with each other. And he says, you know, I want to tell you, Malcolm, I've watched you over the last couple of years. And he says, I want you to know how much I respect you and for what you did for me. He says, but I also want you to know that if you ever need anything from me, I'd love to pay you back. I have to tell you, this is a man that would not let you in. You will not get in. I don't care who you are. He somehow disarmed me. He took my sword and shield off me. Somehow there was all my defenses had dropped. And you know what he'd done? He never once pointed the finger and said, you know what your problem is? If you really loved her, if you really cared about those kids, that's all I was getting at the last, you know, Why don't you just straighten up? Huh? Why don't you be... you've got no respect for yourself. Yeah. No, I don't. That's true. But he never said that. He just said to me, you know what? If there's anything I can do for you, I said, well, what did you have in mind? He says, well, if you want to go to one of these meetings, he says, I'm going to go to one tomorrow. If you want to go with me, I'll take you. And I said, okay. I'm letting somebody, all that hole, the rim and all that stuff, it's just, I'm collapsing. It's like, and he was reaching out, and he gently disarmed everything. He just took the shield off me and the sword off me. You don't need that. It's okay. You're safe. And I went with him, and I sat in the room on Monday, September 11th, 1989. And they said, welcome, Malcolm. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, keep coming back. Yeah. And so I did. I kept coming back. And I kept coming back. But you see, I was this guy who didn't know how to live. And I didn't know how to cope with life. And I had all this stuff that had happened. And it was their fault. You know it was their fault. I didn't do nothing. And I didn't know how to live. But I heard what you were saying. You were telling me that I suffer from a disease. I wasn't a bad person. And I thought I was a bad person. You said you're a sick person, Malcolm. And you got to get well. And maybe we've got a plan for that here. You said, you see, when you take a drink in your body, what happens is you trigger this phenomena of craving. It's called an allergy. It's an abnormal reaction. And in this case, it's alcohol. And a physical response happens when you put it in your body. And the way we treat that is we don't put it in our body. The problem is, Malcolm, our main problem centers in our mind. So sooner or later, we put it in our body because an obsession starts, which is an idea that overrides all other ideas. You see, when that stress builds up, whether you're happy at a wedding or you're depressed at a funeral, you forget that you'll pick up and you'll trigger the phenomenon of craving. And so you take that drink. And I thought, wow, that's... God, I used to take drinks and they took me anywhere they wanted, you know? I could identify with you. And I listened to you for about 3 months and I got it. Once I was still living in my garage. I mean, I had a house to live in, but I lived in my garage. I mean, it was in a sense I'd somehow, it was all part of the theater that I put up for the world to see how I was dying because of you. And you know, I had one of those experiences. It was like, that longest journey is from here to here. I had an experience that suddenly I was aware that I was like unable to drink safely and that I was truly powerless over alcohol. Because when I pick it up, I can't put it down. And I got it. And my life was unmanageable. There's no doubt about that. Look at this. I mean, you see any pieces here that are manageable? I don't, you know. I got it. And I come to believe there was a power greater than me that was you. I believed in you. I had hope because of you. You gave me a feeling like I was important. You put your hand out to me and shook my hand. And you said, welcome, Malcolm. And I thought, God, these guys are incredible. Yeah. And I'm thinking that I'm going to run for president of this organization. And I'm gonna sit on the committees and the boards, and I'm gonna change things a little bit, but they'll get used to it. And I always thought that, you know, I was gonna graduate, I was gonna get your recognition, I was gonna get approval from you, I was dying for your approval somehow, and that it was gonna be okay as long as you loved me, you see. And 3 months into this, I couldn't stand being inside. I had nothing to medicate. I was dry. I was so dry. I was so restless and irritable and discontent. I wanted so desperately just to get out of this, whatever it was. It was just... I could have eaten a 2x4 and it would have been excellent fiber. And I have to tell you, I was just overwhelmed with the fact that I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. And I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die. I wanted to be like you. But I didn't know how to be like you. Because you see, the third step said I had to believe in something that I didn't believe in. I had to turn my whole life over to care of it. Now I'm going to do that. No. What happened is I went back to that garage and I started pacing back and forth. I'm thinking, I gotta have some of these people at night. I mean, they tell me I'm supposed to be honest, but this God stuff, please. Give me a break. There's no God. If there is, he's a cruel bastard. Look what he's done to me. And what happened is I just couldn't say anything else. I couldn't make terms. I want to make terms with him. I want to negotiate a deal. I want to get me out of this and I'll never do that again thing, you know? But he knew that wasn't going to work for me. I had no aces up my sleeve or back pocket plan. I had nothing that was going to, like, you know, just be hip, slick, and cool about, you know? I had no answers. I had no answers. And I stood right on this edge. And I knew I was about to die because I was going to pick up the phone. And I had the stuff delivered. Alcohol was delivered, and the other stuff was delivered, because I didn't leave. And I'll tell you, when I realized I was about to do that, I dropped to my knees, and I said, I have to tell you something. Let me get this straight. Those people that I over there, that fellowship, they told me I have to be honest. I'm going to be real honest with you right now. I will tell you the most honest thing in the world. This is as honest as I can get. I don't believe in you. I don't believe in you. I said, but if there's anybody out there, if there's anybody listening, please, 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 with all my heart, please, let me know. And I died. I died to self. All that ego deflation and all that pride and that self-centered fear dropped away. And that ego was suspended temporarily. And I went into a trance. I went into this, like, body, out-of-body experience. I was just a little bit above me. And I was watching me, rocking back and forwards, just crying. I love to cry. Oh, Dave, you don't know how bad it's been. And that's what I would do. And what happened was that as I saw this wretched human physical alcoholic, look at him, he's dying in self-pity. All of a sudden, another knock came. But this time it was in a different realm. Because I wasn't in my garage anymore. I was in this hall that was like the hall of life. And it was this incredible large place, but there was only one thing in it. It was me, right in the middle of it. And I was pulled back and I was watching me. I was thinking, I'm going totally nuts. What? And there it was. On this side where the garage door was, which was almost falling off, it suddenly transcended into these magnificent doors. And these two doors opened up. And there was this samurai, gladiator, magnificent man with all these symbols of achievement. Shields and things, and he clattered when he walked, like one of them knights. And he walked over to this pathetic creature, and he looked at him, and he dwarfed him by his size. And as he looked at him, he started to take off his helmet and he put his chest piece down. He took his, and he put the sword down, the shield, and he's looking at him. But so he could kneel, because he had to kneel. And he looked at this man, and suddenly his eyes almost popped out of his head for what he saw. What he saw was underneath this man, who was rocking back and forth. And he pushed effortlessly this human body aside of what he saw. And what he saw was the size of this, a little sackcloth. You know, like the big sackcloth they put sand in to stop the water falling? Yeah, a little sackcloth. And he scooped it up and he looked at it. And he listened. And he looked again. And he couldn't believe what he heard and saw. What he heard and saw was a heartbeat. And he looked at it and he recognized something about that heartbeat. He put it back underneath the man. He stood back, he put all his armor on, and he left and turned and walked around. Before he left, he made a signal to somebody behind me. And I don't know what that was, but I suspect that was the living presence or whatever it is that runs my life. Because he's never been seen again. What that was that he saw was the true me. That was the true authentic Malcolm. That was the child abandoned. That was the last self. That was the spiritual part of me that had been abandoned years ago and drowned out day after day after day. The babble. Day after day after day. Babble. Day after day after day. Script running over and over and over and over. And you, and you, and you, and you don't understand. And it's like, you know, all of a sudden, well, I am somebody, you're nobody. And I'm feeling, well, I'm really nobody, you're everything. But I'm really somebody, you're nothing. You see? But that was my true me. And he knew it. And he was the imposter. And he recognized he had lost the war. And he left. And what happened was, I realized that I had one chance, one heartbeat, one breath, one life, and it was mine. And I better take responsibility for it. And I came back to these rooms very quickly after that experience with a brand new outlook on life. And I asked a man, will you please help me? I don't know how to live. I am willing to do anything you tell me to do. Please, would you help me? I didn't say, but I can't do it on Tuesday because I'm busy doing this, and on Sunday afternoon I have to do this. And you know, I had no conditions. I said, would you help me? And he said, yeah. And he went and he told me to do some things. He says, I want you to go to the stag meeting. I want you to go to a big book study. I want to meet on a regular basis and start doing these 12 steps. He says, that's what I want to do. He says, because whatever you had in that garage experience, he says, we've got to hold on to it. He says, I think you met something there. And I think you met your higher power. Oh, great spirit within me. Yeah. And what happened to me is I became willing and teachable. And I did whatever they told me. I cleaned the ashtray. Remember how we used to have ashtrays and smoke? I used to smoke 23 years, guys. The steps cured that. I did all these drugs. The steps cured. I did alcohol right from 9 to, I was like 40, 39, 40 when I gave up alcohol. And I started to work on this program like my life depended on it, because it did. And what happened is, slowly but surely, over the days and over the weeks, I've had a transformation of thought and attitude. I've had a personality change sufficient for me to stay sober just for today. And I keep coming back because I know there's power in these rooms. There's also a relationship I have with that place that I call the spirit within me, my truth. Not yours, my truth. My truth. I call that my God. I can't think of any better word. I like the concept of the living presence. The living presence. He's always living and present when I'm in your company. Yeah. He always reflects back to me when I'm with you. Because one alcoholic talking to another is incredible. It gives life. It gives life. It gives life to each other. And I have to tell you, I am so grateful that just for today, and only for today, I don't pick up and I don't use anything that's going to affect this head of mine, because I don't want to hear the babble anymore. Thanks for letting me share.